Good evening. First off, a welcome back and a mazel tov to the Ganics on the birth of a new grandson to Brad and Efrat. Mazel tov. So exciting. And a welcome to the Merlings who are actually here. This is their date night and they're choosing to spend it to come and learn Torah. That's very impressive. Very impressive. The topic this evening is Lag BaOmer. We'll be discussing briefly Rabbi Akiva and the strength of a wife. And that's why all the husbands are here this evening, to know what to tell their wives they need to be doing better. There's an interesting chazal, which is not a gemara. It's a Tana de Bei Eliyahu, one of the teachings that go back to Eliyahu Anavi. It's a chazal that's quoted often, usually from the husband to the wife. Isha kesheira oiser ritzon bala. What's the definition of an isha kesheira, of a holy, pure wife? So generally it's translated as osa ritzon bala. She does the will of her husband. It's that simple. How do you define a good wife? How do you define a strong wife, a companion, an ezer kenegdo? It's one who obeys her husband. Pretty straightforward. Pretty straightforward. Got to make sure my wife never hears this recording. You know? Now, obviously, that chazal cannot be taken at face value, because we know there's a lot more to the relationship between husband and wife. And there's a lot more that defines an isha kesheira more than obeying or listening to her husband. So I'd like to analyze what those words mean. And if I forget by the time we get to the end of this year, somebody please remind me before we say good evening again, because I want to get back to that line. Isha kesheira osa ritzon bala. We know that the mourning we observe during the 33 days of the Omer is based on the famous story of Rabbi Akiva, and there are many famous stories within this discussion, and therefore it's always hard to actually stay engaged, because once I've heard something before, the natural reaction is, when I'm hearing that same Gemara again in Yevamos and Dav Samach Beis, and the same story of Rabbi Akiva and the daughter of Saba Kavua, I do this. So don't do that. Because although we've heard some of these sources before, the goal is to really analyze them and then put them together to formulate the story of Rabbi Akiva and to explain what was at least part of that magic formula that ignited within Rabbi Akiva to create the personality of Rabbi Akiva, and to maintain the continuity of Torah. So we know the Gemara Yevamos tells us that he had this massive yeshiva, and during the time between Pesach and Shavuos, thousands upon thousands of his Talmidim passed away in a tragic plague and an epidemic because they didn't wear masks. However, the Gemara continues, it says, Va'olam shomeim! The world was desolate, it was destroyed, and when you think about it from a very pragmatic standpoint, not only is the Gemara focusing on the loss of life, but even more than that, the loss of Torah. This was Torah Shebal Peh. They didn't have the Svarim that we have nowadays, we didn't have nearly as much information recorded in writing, and this was the largest yeshiva on the planet, both quantitatively and qualitatively. So you could imagine when the entire yeshiva is decimated, va'olam shamein is to be understood at face value, the world was basically at risk of being totally destroyed. Rabbi Akiva, however, he's able to have the courage and the bitachon to continue, and he goes to the south and he cultivates five new talmidim, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua, Rabbi Shimon referring to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the author of the Zohar. And the Gemara concludes, Heim, Heim, Hemidu Torah Oso Shah. They were the ones to make the Torah stand, right? To continue the Mesorah during that time. And it's based on this, the Ramah Paskins in Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Tov Tzadi Gimel, that on the day of Lag BaOmer, we rejoice a little bit, we play softball, and Yesh Noagim to have a barbecue, Ve'ein Omrim Tachnun. And Ein Omrim Tachnun, if it's a Monday or Thursday, is more of a celebration. Fine. Why do we rejoice on Lag BaOmer a little bit? So it's because at that point in time, the Talmidim stopped passing away. Because at that point, the entire yeshiva was tragically lost. And therefore, we celebrate. And this is a famous question of the Pri Chadash. Famous question of the Pri Chadash is, you would celebrate if somehow the Megefa was stopped and then other Talmidim were allowed to continue living. But if the reason why they all stopped dying was because they were all dead, that doesn't sound like a very good reason for celebration. Oh, very last one just died. We're not going to say Tachnun today, Rabbi Say. Marbim Kitzas B'Simcha. So obviously it's a very difficult Ramah. What are we celebrating? Suggest the Pri Chadash. She says maybe the main focus of this quasi-celebration of Lag BaOmer, Shasimcha hi al osem talmidim shehosev acher kach Rabbi Akiva shalomesu keilu. It could be the main focus is really not that they stopped dying, but looking into the future that Rabbi Akiva had the bitachon, he had the tenacity, he had the perseverance to keep on pushing and never having any sense of yush set in, not allowing himself to feel hopelessness, but to keep on thriving and creating these new Talmidim. So the celebration of Lag BaOmer is really a celebration of the continuity of our Mesorah, the continuation of Torah Shebaal Peh, which is the ikar of the entire world. Now besides this well-known tragedy that Rabbi Akiva went through, losing his entire yeshiva and having to start over again, he went through personal tragedy as well. The Gemara in Moed Katan speaks about a time in his life. It's not clear exactly when chronologically this took place, but he lost two of his sons at the same time. He was sitting Shiva for both of his children. Further, we know on a national level, he was born around the year 50 CE. Not the best time to be born if you were to choose a time and place. So basically, when he was 20 years old, he lived through the Churban Bayis Sheni. He experienced the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. He experienced the exile of hundreds of thousands of Jews, the murder of hundreds of thousands of Jews. He basically lived through the Holocaust. And then decades pass, and we have the revolt of Bar Kokhba. And we have the hope of Beitar, and he was very involved with that movement to the point where the Rambam tells us that Rabbi Akiva and other Gedolim of that time were of the opinion that Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach, and they had this very strong anticipation that the Geula was literally around the corner. Until that tragic day came, Ad Shenerag Ba'avonos, Bar Kokhba was killed in battle. And at that point, Kevan Shenerag, once he was dead, Noda Lehem She'eno, it became clear that he was not the Mashiach. It seems, based on this Rambam, that once somebody passes away, we no longer assume they are Mashiach. His greatness in Torah was unparalleled. And that's the famous Gemara Menachos, where Moshe Rabbeinu is shown this glimpse into the future. He's actually taken in a time machine to see Rabbi Akiva teaching his Talmidim, and the depth and the brilliance and the creativity of his darshaning. It was to the point where it says Moshe Rabbeinu was cholish daite. He had a sense of chalishas hadas. He was taken aback. He was overwhelmed by the magnitude of the grasp of Torah that Rabbi Akiva possessed. And it wasn't just in the realm of the revealed Torah, it was also within Nister, within the hidden Torah. That's the famous Gemara in Chagiga that says that we had Arba Nichnasu the Pardes. Four of the great Tanayim entered together into the orchard. Into the orchard is a reference to dangerous, deep Kabbalistic study. And out of all four of these great personalities, it was only Rabbi Akiva Yotza B'Sholom. He was able to come out of the intensity of that exploration whole, and he was unscathed by it. The other three were impacted forever. Probably the most famous story we've heard before of Rabbi Akiva is the water dripping on the rock. And this seems to be how the Avos Reb Nosson describes his haschala, his beginning, his initial desire to learn Torah. It has the whole background that he was 40 years old, and up until that point in life, lo shana klum. Literally that means he didn't learn anything. Lo shana klum. So we assume by the time he was 40, he was an am oritz deraisa, he was an ignoramus, he didn't know anything. And then he has this strange experience. Not the type of experience that you would classify as mystical. Many years ago, before I became computer literate, I would go every Friday to the FedEx, and I would bring in with me about 25 svarim, and I would be there for 2 hours Friday afternoon making photocopies and cutting and pasting. I got really good at cutting and pasting to the point where I knew everyone's name and they knew me, and I would walk in, hey, how are you? John, how's it going? So there was one Friday I was running later than usual, and I'm standing there frantically by the machine and trying to copy and enlarge, and this older lady comes walking up to me very slowly with the big binder. And I could smell there was something here. So I say, hi, good afternoon. And she says, can I share with you my portfolio? I'm like, no way. Yeah, it's like 4:30, I have a lot to do. I'm like, I'm very intrigued, but the truth is I'm actually working. I have to run home in like a half hour. She's like, can I just show you a couple of quick pictures? So how do you say no to a nice old lady? So I said, sure. She starts opening the page and she's showing me the picture of the clouds and the sky. This cloud over here, you see what that is? I said, it looks like a cloud. I said, no, that's Mother Mary. And when she came to me, can I just tell you a story about how I felt? At that point, I had to say, you know what? I would love to hear more, but I really got to finish up. Hatzlacha, bracha v'hatzlacha. I had to gracefully go the other direction. Lahavdil, this was not Rabbi Akiva's experience. It wasn't a mystical feeling of the clouds and the formation. It was just the water on the rock. And him coming to this internal conclusion, hey, if water, which is soft, can do this to the hard rock, oh, it must be the Torah, which is mamish, so powerful, of course that could penetrate my heart and soul. And at that point, Avos Reb Nosson says, that was his initial inspiration. And miyad chazer lilmud Torah, immediately, chazer lilmud Torah, chazer means he went back to learning Torah. So it's kind of confusing, because on one hand, he was 40 years old, lo shana klum. He didn't learn anything. But then it's telling us he went back to learning, which obviously implies that he was involved with learning beforehand. So it seems like, and we have this from other sources, that he was involved with learning, but he was turned off. He lost his interest. He felt rejected by his experience of learning to the point of lo shana klum, right? He was like in high school. Lo shana klum. Nothing was happening, although he was somewhat involved. Only after this inspirational experience, then miyad chazer lilimudo. Immediately he went back to his learning. And we know famously he went together with his son. They found one of the Melamdei Tinokos, one of the teachers of small children, and Rabbi Akiva said, Rabbi Lamdeini Torah. And he sat down together with his child, with a whole bunch of other kids, likely, And they learn from the very beginning, Aleph Beis, and then Chumash, and then Mishnah, Ad Shalomet Kola Torah Kula, until the point where he was able to master the entirety of Torah. Then he went to Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, who were two of the Gedolim of that time, and he said, please, Pischuli Ta Mishnah, teach me the reasoning behind the Mishnayos, which is basically what we call Gemara. Teach me Gemara. So as soon as they would teach him one halacha, halach v'yashiv lo beino lebein atzmo, which is parenthetically a very powerful insight. How are you kona Torah? How does one really acquire the wisdom of Torah? If we're just blitzing through things to cover ground, to feel a superficial sense of accomplishment by going through a lot of material, that will never result in a real kinyan ha-Torah. Rabbi Akiva was able to learn Kol HaTorah Kula because when he heard something, he integrated it. Holach v'yoshev lo beino lebein atzmo. He thought about it. He processed the information. I assume included in this is he reviewed the information and he made it part of himself. If he was involved with learning, though, initially when he was younger, why did he leave learning? Rabbi Yisrael Salanter alludes to this in a letter where he just says one line that Rabbi Akiva, when he was younger, it's true, he did go to yeshiva, but he didn't feel any connection to the learning, and therefore he felt it was a waste of his talent, it was a waste of his time. He had so much to offer the world, and sitting here in the shir, spacing out, what am I doing? And then we find the Gemara in Pesachim. The Gemara in Pesachim adds a different layer where it wasn't just the lack of interest, but there was a feeling of rejection. The Gemara in Pesachim quotes over what Rabbi Akiva would tell his students after he already mastered Kol HaTorah Kula. He would share with his Talmidim, this was a good thing to do at the Purim Suda. Right, we mentioned last week about Rabbi Chanan Wasserman at the Purim Suda telling over the story of the Dibuk. So Rabbi Akiva would share with his Talmidim, when I was younger, before I was 40 years old, I had such a hatred for Talmidei Chachamim to the point where I actually felt, Mi yitein li Talmud Chacham v'anashchenu kachamor, if only someone would give me a Torah scholar that I'd be able to bite like a donkey. And the Talmidim asked the obvious question, why the analogy of a donkey? Usually you would say bite like a dog. That's much more of a normal metaphor. And the response of Rabbi Akiva was, no, because when a dog bites, it doesn't break bones. When a donkey bites, it does break bones. Meaning to say, there was such an aggression that I had when I was younger towards the people that represented Torah, I wanted to bite them and break their bones. Now, where did that come from? That would almost give an indication that he must have been a really grubba, mean, ill-natured type of person. But we know that's not who he was. We're going to see in a moment the reason why the daughter of Kalba Sabua was so intrigued and interested in Rabbi Akiva is because she saw how refined he was, how modest he was. So generally, when you think of a refined and modest person, someone who's just pure-natured, you don't think of them as wanting to bite Talmidei Chachamim and break their bones. Usually those two things don't go together. So Tosfos is actually bothered by this question. And he says, he didn't have a disdain for Talmidei Chachamim because he just was a mean guy, or because he had an agenda to take down those people because I rebel against Torah. But rather, Mishum Shehaya Sovar Shemis Goyin Al Amei Haaretz Mipnei Torasan. Rabbi Akiva had this feeling that the Torah scholars of his time felt some level of arrogance, because they were learned, they had a wide range knowledge of Shas and Poskim, And Rabbi Akiva felt, when they're looking at me, whether or not this was true, we don't know, but at least his perception was, they're looking down on me. There's a holier-than-thou type of interaction, and that created such a feeling of sinna, such a resentment, which is also a very interesting insight, that whenever I feel you're not respecting me for where I am or who I am, and I get the sense that you're looking down on me, it's very natural, even if you're a great person, to feel a really strong resentment. When we read the Gemara in Ksubis that speaks about the initial meeting of the daughter of Kalba Savua, who was Kalba Savua? So people don't actually realize this, but he was on the Knicks in the 1970s. Right? The Knicks who just, I hear, fell out of the running. Aleihem Hashalom. Kalba Savua, before he joined the Knicks, he was actually a very wealthy real estate type of person, and he had land and animals, and he was very influential. And the Gemara relates that Rabbi Akiva was one of the shepherds, one of the many shepherds that worked for Kalba Savua. And there is one moment in time where the daughter, her name is not mentioned here, but we know from the Masorah her name was Rachel, that Rachel saw Rabbi Akiva, Tahavit Tzniya Mali. And the two attributes that she picked up on were Tzniya, he was modest, Umali, and he was refined. And therefore, she approaches him and says, how would you feel about making a deal? I'll allow you to marry me if you agree to go off to yeshiva and learn Torah. And his response from the Gemara, it sounds like it was pretty much an immediate reaction. He said, yes, okay. They didn't shake on it yet, but he nodded his head and he said, yes, I agree. They wanted to keep this a secret from her father, Kalba Savua, because he only was interested in her dating real Talmidei Chachamim, not Amaratzim, people who knew nothing, people who were described by the Avos Reb Nosson as Lo Shona Klum. He didn't learn anything. So they tried hiding it from her father, but he found out. He was very angry, very disappointed in the choice that his daughter made, and he basically said, I want nothing to do with you. And I'm making a neder, I'm taking a vow that you can't benefit from any of my property. So you're going to have to fend for yourself. Hatzlacha, good luck. Rabbi Akiva goes off to yeshiva. And the story in the Gemara in Ksubas continues. And here we have a line that needs to be in the introduction of every sefer. There's probably some unspoken rule that whenever you're writing a sefer and you're introducing it, you're thanking people, thou shalt quote this line, otherwise you're not yotzei writing a sefer. What is the line that everyone quotes? It's based on this Gemara, where after many years, Rabbi Akiva comes back, and Rachel hears about the fact that he's on his way, he's coming back with his Talmidim. So likely this means chronologically this is before the epidemic. And she chooses just to run outside and wait there for him. And her friends ask her, why don't you put on something nice? Why don't you put on some makeup? This is going to be a reunion after so many years with your husband. And her response is, quoting the Pasuk in Mishlei, Yodei Tzadik Nefesh Behemto. The righteous man knows the soul of his animal. And they said, what are you talking about? What? Okay. But that was the Pasuk she quoted in Mishlei. Fine. So she didn't put on anything nice. She ran outside. And then you have this very special moment. You could imagine it. Rabbi Akiva is walking there with his entourage, with his devoted Talmidim, with a great sense of anticipation to be reunited with his wife after so many years. And she comes running over and she falls and she starts kissing his feet. And at that point, you could imagine all the Hasidim around him, right? You can't do that to the Rebbe. You can't even shake his hand, right? Even if you were a man, you couldn't shake his hand. Kissing the Rebbe, what are you doing? They start pushing her away. And then Rebbe Akiva says, Shavkua, let her be. Sheli v'shelechem shelohu. Because everything that I am and everything that you are, really, shelohu, belongs to her. Leave her be. Basically saying, this is the Rebbetzin, right? These are my Talmidim, and you should know everything we've been able to do over these last many years, and the people that we've transformed ourselves into through our Torah, through our Devekis, Shelohu, it's all because of her. Her father hears that there's this massive Talmud Chacham in the community, and he's been feeling so guilty about the vow he's taken not to support his daughter, and he's seen firsthand her suffering. So he runs over to this Talmud Chacham, not knowing it's actually Rebbe Akiva, and says, can you help me be mefer neder? Can you help me annul the vow that I made so many years ago, saying that I'm not going to support my daughter and son-in-law? Because I thought he was an Am Haaretz, but now I feel so much regret for saying that. And Rebbe Akiva says back to him before revealing himself, if you would have known that theoretically your son-in-law would develop and evolve into a Talmud Chacham, would you have made that same vow not to support their family? And Kalba Savua's response was, even if he would even learn a Mishnah, a Perek, something, I would never have made that vow. And then Rabbi Akiva says, Anna hu. Guess what? I'm Akiva. Ani Yosef, right? I'm Akiva. What's confusing is that when you try to put all of these different stories together, and the end of this narrative in Ksubis, where he's basically saying, it's all because of my wife. So there are a few things we have to analyze. First of all, why did she want to marry Akiva? Right? Before he was Rabbi Akiva. What was her motivation? What was her machshava? The Ben Ish Chai is actually bothered by this question, and the way that he expresses it is that she knew very well that there were other young men who also had sterling midos, who you might also describe as Tzniu Mali. And she would not have gone against the wishes of her father. She could have made him proud. She could have brought nachas to the family, avoided all of the busha that goes along with, yeah, my daughter married the shepherd. She could have brought nachas to her father. Why did she choose Rabbi Akiva? What was she thinking? What's also strange is when you start putting together and piecing together the story, what was it that got him to learn? When we hear about the Avos de Reb Nosson account that he saw the water and he was inspired to go back to his learning. So it was about that moment of inspiration, his portfolio, lahavdil. But then when you read the Gemara in Ksubis, it mentions nothing about water and a rock. It just says, she made a deal. If you want to marry me, go learn Torah. And he said, okay. What was that spark that went off? What's also somewhat confusing is if he was so turned off by Torah earlier on in life, to the point where he said, when I saw those people that represent Torah, I wanted to mamish, get violent with them. I wanted to break their bones. How does it work? But then I was sitting by a stream and I saw the water dripping onto the rock and I thought to myself, I should really go back to learning Torah. Most people probably were not thinking along those lines. And coming from his trauma and his baggage and his interactions, which were clearly very negative, why would he think along those lines? So what happened first, and how in the world did he see this water? How did that ignite the inspiration when he had so much bitter memories. One last question I want to delve into briefly is, why did she brush off her neighbors and say, I'm not going to get my nice clothing on, I'm not going to put my makeup on? Tzadik yodeya nefesh behemto. Like, what does that mean? And then to like lose yourself and to start giving a hug and a kiss in public. She herself appreciated him because he was so modest and refined. This is not how modest and refined people interact in public. There's a Gemara in Baba Basra, and this is Paskin in Shulchan Aruch and Evan Ezer, that husband and wife do not show physical affection in public. So what was she doing? It was keneged halacha. So the Ben Yoyada, the Ben Yishchai, basically fills in some of the missing gaps of the story in an incredible way. He says, if you look at the Avos de Reb Nosson, so he went back to learning who joined him? His son. So he had a son already? That means he was married? But he didn't start learning until he got engaged. So says the Ben Yoyada, what's not said explicitly in the life and the biography of Rabbi Akiva is that he was clearly married before. And he had a family prior to meeting the daughter of Kalba Savua. And he had sons and daughters. He had a family. Unfortunately, his first wife was Nifteris. She passed away. Then he starts working for Kalba Savua. He meets the daughter. They have this conversation. Explains the Ben Yoyada, although it's not clear in the Gemara, when she offers this deal, I'll marry you if you go to learn, he didn't say yes immediately. Right? It makes sense. A decision like this, you want to think about just a little bit. You're basically asking me to change my life in order to marry you. And generally, we have a klal gadol b'Torah, a guiding principle, which is don't ever marry somebody assuming that they're going to change, because they're not going to change. And don't ever marry someone assuming that you're going to change, because, al pi derech hateva, you're not going to change. That sounds kind of pessimistic. So obviously Rabbi Akiva had to think about this carefully. And as he was thinking about this, that's when the story of Avos de Rabbi Nosson takes place. That's when he's sitting there and he sees the water dripping onto the rock. That's why his mind was going in that direction. It wasn't coming out of left field. He was now thinking deeply about the possibility of going back to learning. And clearly, one of the major hurdles was his lack of belief in himself. I didn't learn anything before. Lo shana klum. He was an amoritz. He knew nothing, even though he was sitting there in shir. And he had a hatred for Talmidei Chachamim because, in his perception, they were looking down on him. But now there's an opportunity that's come my way. Maybe this could be that pivotal point in my life. Maybe if I do take her hand in marriage, that could uplift me. Am I ready to go back to learning? Do I think I could do it? I've been living with this understanding of myself up until now that it's not for me. But that's why he was able to see something much deeper into that very mundane experience. And who did he take with him to learning? He took a child from his first marriage, not a child from the daughter of Kalba Savua. That's how the Ben Yoyada explains the entire situation. Which is so interesting because we had a question, how can she just go out and not care about her physical appearance, just go and give a hug and a kiss? Where's the tzniyus? Says the Ben Yoyada, I want to read to you these words, Ahavaso imi avas nefesh, which she was telling her friends and neighbors, by quoting that verse in Mishlei, is that you don't understand the relationship that we have. His love for me and my connection with him is an avas nefesh. Ki yodeya tzadik sha'ani bazugo ba'olam ha'neshamos. Because he knows and I know that there's a connection that's not limited to this world, but it's a connection in the olam ha'neshamos. We actually quoted before on Shabbos from the Zohar that speaks about the idea of a zivug not being limited to olam hazeh. And that's why if you're ever attending a wedding where the person conducting the ceremony says, until death do we part, you stand up and say, Sheker v'chazov! Death is not a separation either. Never learned the Zohar, Am Haaretz. It's a zivug, it's a devekis of neshamas. Nishmosa b'nishmosa, nehoira b'nehoira. That was the language of the Zohar. Soul and soul, fire and fire, that's l'nitzchiyus. That's why she didn't feel any pressure to make sure to put on makeup, because she knew at this point in their life, at this point in their personal development and their movement as a couple, there was such a kesher nafshi. We don't need anything chatzonius. We need nothing that's external. And that's why giving a hug and a kiss, people on that madrega, there's no halachic issue. The halachic issue of showing affection in public, as is clear from the source in the Gemara and the commentators on Shulchan Aruch, is you're basically expressing some level of physical taiva, and that's very unhealthy and inappropriate to do in a public setting. Because first of all, that might awaken feelings of taiva in others, or at the same time, feelings of jealousy. And that's just totally inappropriate. What needs to be private and sanctified needs to stay private and sanctified. When there's a Devekis HaNefesh on this level with Rabbi Akiva, or I'll give you another example. Somebody told me that I saw firsthand, and you'll see no pun intended, he said, I saw firsthand Rav Moshe Feinstein walking, holding hands with his Rebbetzin. Right? So I know that holding hands in public is not a problem. Okay. So why is that particular story not a proof or an indication to anything? Right? Why is that particular story not a reason to tell a young married couple in their 20s, yeah, go for it, hold hands in public, it's okay. Rav Moshe did it. That was a very different form of Devekis HaNefesh. And there's a practical element of maybe you're helping the Rebbetzin, she doesn't trip. And maybe she's helping her husband that he doesn't slip. But it's a whole different vibe. That's why she came out not needing any of those externalities. Now it's interesting, there's a different passage in the Avos to Reb Nosson where it says, no one should ever say, I was so poor, I wasn't able to learn. Because look at Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had nothing. His father-in-law didn't give him a dime. And he was still able to learn day and night. However, Avos to Reb Nosson continues and says, you can't bring any proof from Rabbi Akiva. Mipnei shezochsa Rachel ishto, because he was zocha to have Rachel as a wife. Meaning to say, explains the Mogen Avos, the commentary on Avos to Reb Nosson, that shiny Rebbe Akiva sheishto haisa kesheira v'hanichosu leleches lelmatora. You can't show anything, Rebbe Akiva, because he had Rachel. She was an isha kesheira. She was supportive in his learning. She encouraged him to go out at night, even though it could have been a lot more convenient having him here and help with the kids and help with dinner time and bedtime. But because she was there encouraging him and inspiring him, so don't bring me any proof from Rabbi Akiva because he had Rachel. Why did she choose Rabbi Akiva if she had so many other great Talmidei Chachamim who also had beautiful midos? Answer is very simple. Says the Ben Yoyada, her desire to get married wasn't just a selfish pursuit. I want to find a guy who's at least 6'2" and learning in yeshiva, but he has to wear this brand of white shirt, right? Okay. She understood. She saw the potential. Why go for potential versus actuality? So she said to herself, if I could be instrumental in taking this person to the next level and transforming him by creating this deal and bringing him to that reality, so then it's not just I'm supporting someone who would have been doing this anyway, but I'm the goreim. I'm the one who's allowing and who's causing this to happen. That means I have a real chelik in everything that he's accomplishing. And that's why he said, you should know, Talmidim, everything that I am and everything that you are, it's all because of my wife. Not just that she was the one supporting me throughout the years and allowing me to spend time growing in my ruchnius, but the fact she chose to marry me in the first place. That shelah, that's all coming from her. Isha kashera osa ratzon bala. What does it mean? The definition of a good wife is someone who does the ratzon bala. I'll tell you a pshat, and don't hate me for this because it's far from muchrach. I can't tell you this is what it actually means, but there's truth here. Isha kashera osa ratzon bala. If you're an Isha Kishera, you make the Ratzon of your Baal. Doesn't mean you do his Ratzon, but you're able to create a Ratzon within him because he feels that you're there and you're supporting and you're embracing and you're encouraging and you believe in him. Isha Kishera Osa Ratzon Baala. You could create that Ratzon towards Ruchnius. You could enhance and intensify that desire to come closer to Torah when an Isha Kashera, when one's wife not only allows or puts up with the fact that he's doing something in Ruchnius, but you could create that Ratzon by being the Gorim, by being the cause, by being his inspiration. Shkoyach.